Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 21st of August. This hour of the program, we talk about a report that says that the Environmental Protection Agency has cited six counties in the state of Wisconsin for fine particle pollution. This is the first time that these counties have been designated as violating federal standards for fine particle pollution. They are Milwaukee, Waukesha, Racine, Dane, Columbia, and Brown. The agency looked at many scientific studies on how these particles, and we'll find out what they are, affect the lungs and the heart, and gave the conclusion that allowable daily limits for these levels must fall by quite a large percent, 46%. It would result, obviously, in better health and also would result in a cost savings of $9 to $75 billion a year. Some groups have been opposed to the reductions. They feel that there will be more regulations and higher costs for the affected companies over the next 5 years. And there is still a period for public comment if designations become a reality. The issue is going to be discussed this hour by two guests. We'll have our first guest for just a few minutes. He's on his way to a meeting in Chicago, and our other guest will be with us for the entire hour. Al Shea is with us, Administrator of the Air and Waste Division for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and joining us in just a little while, but we'll say hello to her as well right now, Professor Tracy Holloway, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies, Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and Civil and Environmental Engineering at the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Al, good morning to you. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Good morning, Kathleen. Yes. Pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, nice to have you here. And Professor Holloway, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, nice to have you here. Al, let's start with you. Why is this the first time that this many Wisconsin counties have been designated violating federal standards for fine particle pollution? How were the tests done, and what is this pollution?
The tests were done basically on monitored data in the state, and there were three counties that had monitored levels below the threshold that EPA had established. Those were Dane, Brown, and Milwaukee. Typically what EPA does is also look at counties that are upwind of places where there are air quality violations and include those counties in their non-attainment designations. But maybe a little primer on what fine particles are.
Mm-hmm.
They are solid or liquid particles in the atmosphere that are less than 2.5 microns in diameter. In other words, they're very, very small. They are typically caused by chemical reactions or condensation of gases. There are three main constituents to fine particles, and those are, at the risk of getting too scientific here, ammonium sulfate, ammonium nitrate, and organic carbon. And the major sources of fine particles in the state are sulfur dioxide emissions from power plants, nitrogen oxide emissions from combustion and boilers, such also from power plants as well as motor vehicles, and organic carbon that comes from either background from the earth or from motor vehicles or other kinds of transportation activities.
Mm-hmm. So what's the worst offender, the power plants or the motor vehicles?
Power plants usually lead the list when you talk about both the magnitude of emissions, whether it's SO2, NOx, those things that contribute to fine particles or ozone pollution. They also generally have the most cost-effective controls. Obviously, you can go to one major power plant, install controls, rather than trying to take on a whole fleet of vehicles, as an example.
Mm-hmm. And what do we do about it? How do you lessen it?
There are terms of art that describe some of the major controls that are put on power plants. I think all of us have heard the word scrubber used.
Mm-hmm.
These are giant pieces of equipment that are placed basically between where the coal comes into a coal-fired power plant and the smokestack that essentially scrub the fuel and remove considerable amounts of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide as well as other constituents.
Mm-hmm.
Kathleen, just for a minute, I suspect that that Dr. Holloway will be dealing with this much more eloquently than I will, but just to talk about why do we care about fine particles? We care about them because recent evidence over the last decade or more has shown increasingly that the health impacts of these fine particles, when they are inhaled, they can lead to several health issues, which include decreased lung function, increased asthma attacks, and chronic bronchitis, acute respiratory symptoms. Those symptoms or those things can lead to respiratory and cardiopulmonary-related hospital admissions. They can increase work and school absences and, unfortunately, can lead to premature death.
So at this point, the EPA is telling those power plants or telling those people who drive cars that they have to carpool, the power plants need to clean up their act. Whose responsibility is it?
Well, now you get into some of the arcane provisions of the Federal Clean Air Act. The reality is that the responsibility after the non-attainment designations are made, and again, the announcement 2 days ago by EPA was really a signal of their intent. They will make their final decision in December of this year, but it, normally they stick with their original proposals. After that point, it's really turned over to the individual states to design programs or develop regulations to control whatever the particular pollutant is. So it'll be up to the state of Wisconsin to work with our utilities and industries to control particulate matter pollution. And, in fact, we have a rule that was just rejected by the Assembly yesterday, the Assembly Natural Resources Committee, which would do just that. In fact, not only would the rule that we have before the Assembly address particulate matter non-attainment, but it would also address ozone non-attainment. And as I'm sure you're aware, we have nine counties that are still designated as non-attainment for ozone as well.
And it was rejected because the thought was that it would be too expensive for companies to do this, or what?
Well, it's far from me to say what was on the minds of the, and it was rejected on a straight party vote. So it's not for me to guess what their concern was there. The department's proposal is the most cost-effective way to deal with not only fine particulate and ozone pollution, but also for mercury reductions. That has to do with the fact that you can install, as an example, a scrubber at a facility which has very, very significant reductions in SO2 and NOx. That's that sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides.
Yes.
But also, at the same time, without installing any specific mercury control equipment, you will get upwards of 70% reduction of mercury as well. So it's obviously a very cost-effective way to go after all three of these very onerous pollutants.
And how much does a scrubber cost?
They're very, very expensive. This this is not an inexpensive proposition. The wet scrubber that We Energies, which installed at their Pleasant Prairie plant, which was the first one in the state, cost around $350 million.
Oh, my gosh.
But let me remind you that on the flip side, and this is the part of the discussion that rarely gets air, if you will, so I appreciate the opportunity this morning to do so, which is air pollution costs the state a lot of money in public health costs. We ran a model that EPA has for estimating such things that's called the COBRA model, and it was estimated that annually in the state of Wisconsin, the current air quality that we have costs upwards of $230 million a year. So you can make up, if you will, the cost of a scrubber in a very short period of time.
The governor and the DNR, according to press reports yesterday, have said that planned reductions by utilities and industry and anticipated cuts, which yesterday's action by the Assembly may prove otherwise, from the mercury regulations will ratchet down the emissions. Are you confident that's the case?
Yes, we've run models, and we believe we will get the state back into attainment for, again, the fine particulates, but also ozone in the neighborhood of 2015. That is if the rule that we have in front of the legislature now gets enacted.
Right. Did this happen all of a sudden, or when things were measured last year, were they pretty high and we just went over the top this year?
Yeah, there's another artifact that should be discussed. There was a previous standard for fine particulates, which was set at 65 micrograms per cubic meter, which is the way they measure the pollutant. And recently, because of new evidence of the impact of fine particulates on public health, the national standard was changed from 65 to 35. Mm-hmm. There were no counties in the state that were in violation of the 65 micrograms per cubic meter, but when they moved it to 35, then we had those three counties, Dane, Brown, and Milwaukee, that had violations.
Mm-hmm. And some of these counties, as I understand it, are in violation of one aspect of the Clean Air Standard, and some are in violation of another?
Correct. Milwaukee County, unfortunately, is currently in, as an example, in non-attainment for what we call the old ozone 8-hour standard. It's also now been at least nominated, if you will, as being non-attainment for the fine particulate standard. And EPA also just recently established a new ozone standard that is more stringent, and Milwaukee County would be in violation of that standard as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the point that the department has taken is, rather than trying to deal with these pollutants one at a time, which is a very expensive and time-consuming proposition, we wanted to put a rule out there that would allow utilities to invest, plan and invest one time for all of these pollutants, and we would really get at the root of all of these pollutants and get us back into attainment.
Mm-hmm. At one time, so that time needs to be, what, fairly soon, Al?
Well, the planning and installation and capitalization of these very expensive pollution control devices takes quite some time. There's a process they have to go through with the Public Service Commission. They obviously also have to go through a formal air permitting process. So you're talking about between now and 2015, between when, you know, the regulations get established here in the state, hopefully yet this fall, and the point when those control devices would actually be installed and operating.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I know you have to be on your way to Chicago, so we don't want to hold you up. I really appreciate your being with us to give us the details of this, the first part of our show. Thanks, Al.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks. Enjoy your day.
Thank you. Al Shea is Administrator of the Air and Waste Division for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And now Professor Tracy Holloway joining us for the remainder of this hour, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies, Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and Civil and Environmental Engineering, the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It comes down sometimes, Professor Holloway, to an individual decision, too. People will hear this report, and particularly people who have health problems or are concerned about relatives and friends who have health problems, that you have to stay inside. I remember a warning that came in the winter last year, and I was thinking, what the heck is this? We're getting an alert during the December, which we've never had before. Will they be comforted knowing that the EPA wants to clean up the act in Wisconsin?
Well, I think so. You bring up a couple good points there, one being that this is a year-round problem for particulate matter, whereas ozone is only a summertime problem. So there's some interesting differences between this PM2.5 issue and ozone. But thinking about the individual who may have respiratory disease or maybe more sensitive, one challenge is that there's not really obvious things that an individual could do if they know that it's a high PM2.5 day.
Mm-hmm.
If you have asthma and you hear that it's an ozone action day, or now I think they're just called air quality alert days, you can go inside an air-conditioned area, and that will really reduce your ozone exposure. But oftentimes, indoor PM2.5 concentrations are even higher than outdoors. So there's nowhere that a sensitive person can really go to escape high outdoor PM2.5.
Hmm. And why is it a problem indoors?
Well, indoor smoke, dust, emissions from industrial carpets, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, the just that you have a trapped environment with a lot of stuff. I mean,
mm-hmm.
as Al Shea pointed out, he gave a great overview of this issue, and that PM2.5 can be almost any liquid or particle in the atmosphere. So when you're near a construction site and you see all that wind-blown dust, that is contributing to PM2.5. If you had a monitor right there, mm-hmm. it would be giving a very high reading. And so indoors, you have different types of things in the atmosphere, but you have a trapped environment, so sometimes those are higher.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the sensitive health population in the state should feel pretty good that the EPA is cracking down on this. On the other hand, you know, here in Wisconsin, we do have pretty good air. It's not like we're living in Beijing right now, during where there's been a lot of coverage of air quality for the Olympics, which is much worse than it is anywhere in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a judgment call as to how much do you tighten the screws for air pollution, and how much do you want to keep the cost down for industries, and both of those are important goals.
Right. Now, I don't know if they've been measuring the air in China, but I've been watching the Olympics somewhat avidly, and I was amazed. I think it was Brian Williams 2 days ago was talking about how the air quality had improved so dramatically there. And I was thinking, could this happen in this short a period of time by taking cars off the road, by shutting down some factories?
It really can.
Wow.
Yeah. There's two big things that control what the air pollution is. One is how much emissions are being created, and the second is what the weather patterns are.
Mm-hmm.
So a big reason why Beijing's air quality over the past few days has been better than it could have been is because they've had good luck with some of the weather patterns coming through. But actually, even these short-term changes in reducing the amount of cars and reducing the industrial activities can have a very noticeable effect. And actually, there was a big study that came out a couple of years after the Atlanta Olympics, where they had cut down the number of cars on the road in Atlanta around the Olympics, too, and there was a real drop in the number of asthma cases that checked into the ER just because there was less ozone in the air.
My. So what does that tell us? That's fairly dramatic, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So it really, I mean, it's not just smoke and mirrors. It is something that you can really see when you have these situations where they cut down on the emissions, and you can really see a clear health benefit to the community.
Right. Let's go to phone calls. We have tons of them coming in. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Professor Tracy Holloway, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies, Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and Civil and Environmental Engineering at the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our topic today, the EPA citing six counties in Wisconsin for fine particle pollution. To your calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now and start our calls with Roger from Iowa County. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I have a question. We often talk about, you know, with the electric companies, but we never was so seldom talked about they're producing electricity for us. So I'm wondering what, and I'm just looking for any ballpark numbers that you may know, what are their profit margins? And if scrubbers were put in place, the cost, how would that affect either their profit margins, or what would the cost of the percentage of increase in electric costs need to be to consumers to pay for cleaner air? Because they're producing it for us.
Mm-hmm. Good question.
Yeah, that is a great question, and I don't have really even a ballpark of the cost. In part because it's complicated because the rates are set by the Public Service Commission here in Wisconsin, and so it's not really a free market system. And so I think when their costs go up, then they lobby for a increase in the rates. But there are exactly trade-offs between, I mean, all of these, the increased restrictions and increased costs that the electric companies have to bear are always going to be passed on to the consumer. And these trade-offs get quite complicated to be working with, because you think, you know, gee, it would be nice to have an electric supply source that didn't produce any emissions. Well, nuclear energy is one such option. But there's a moratorium on building nuclear in Wisconsin, and a lot of people are opposed to nuclear. And so then you say, okay, well, let's think about things that don't emit and that aren't nuclear. And what about wind? Well, wind is a great option, but right now there's no storage system for wind energy, so that wind energy only goes to the grid when the wind is blowing. And oftentimes the times that electricity demand is highest is on these hot summer days when there's not much wind.
Mm-hmm.
So until we have a storage system for wind energy, that's not going to be able to replace coal or nuclear or natural gas. Natural gas is a lot cleaner than coal, but it's also more expensive, and the price can be volatile. So if you're thinking about what kind of a power plant you want to build, you might shy away from building a natural gas plant because you don't know what's going to happen to natural gas prices mm-hmm. over the next 10 or 15 or 30 years. So each one of these electric supply options has their own set of pros and cons. And unfortunately, there's none that are perfect. But how it exactly plays out to the company's bottom line, I'm not sure.
When you hear that figure that Al said, $350 million for a scrubber, what are your thoughts? Do you think, oh, my gosh, how in the world are we going to pay for this? Or do you think, well, there is a way for us to pay for this?
Well, I think there is a way to pay for this. I mean, these power plants have a tremendously long lifetime. The average power plant has a lifetime of about 50 years.
Mm.
I don't know what the lifetime of the scrubber on that facility is, but these are really long-term investments. And a single power plant can be supplying electricity to hundreds of thousands of homes. So even though it's a huge number, when you spread it over a long period of time and spread it over a huge number of people on a day-to-day basis and every refrigerator and air conditioner that's going, it really brings that cost down to more
right.
more on the couple cents per person per day, for instance, or
mm-hmm.
probably even less than that. So I think it is though a huge number, and these aren't decisions to be taken lightly. And so that's one reason why there's so much attention
right.
on this new redesignation recommendation.
But certainly when you put it that way, it puts a whole different light on this, a couple cents a day.
Yeah.
Thanks, Roger, for your great question. Tom is next from Viroqua. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good morning. Here in western Wisconsin, one of the major environmental issues is the Dairyland Power Corporation, which the EPA is requiring to put a scrubber on. Of course, this is very important both for our air quality and for those of us downwind. However, both the EPA and the DNR and Dairyland, in fact, have been looking at this from the very narrow lens of just air quality. They're not considering the fact that by putting on this scrubber, they're going to be creating toxic fly ash that can no longer be recycled, and the big battle is over whether they're going to create a large landfill and haul this fly ash to the landfill, where then which is taking up valuable farmland, major added pollution from the process, and the resultant runoff from this rainfall or from this landfill gets sent off to a water treatment plant, and the sludge of which then gets land spread. So they're just essentially taking the same pollutants and switching it from an air quality to a groundwater quality and spreading these same toxins, you know, over a much wider area. The real crime in this, however, is Dairyland Power is using this project as an excuse to buy high sulfur coal, which they can barge up from Illinois, rather than using the low sulfur coal they've been using now from the western states, which is going to result in much more sulfur dioxide and other issues, you know, needs to be caught up. And the fact that the Dairyland, a non-regulated utility, has done absolutely nothing other than give out a few compact fluorescent light bulbs to do anything to help their consumer members to be more efficient and reduce their absolute load. So I think that the real danger is by looking at these issues from a narrow focus of, oh, we got to take care of this, and this air quality issue, but not looking at the grand picture and saying that we really, if we're going to be able to improve the quality of our air and our land and our water, we've really got to be using less electricity and put serious effort and resources into reducing our demand.
Well, I think you bring up a great point there, and covers a lot of issues. I don't really know much about Dairyland Power in particular, but this issue that, you know, there's these trade-offs, and each one of these environmental issues is connected with others, and the air, the water, the solid waste, you know, that there's problems with looking at each of these individually. You know, the flip side, though, is that back, you know, sort of when you think about the 70s and the environmental movement, and it was a sort of broad Save the Earth effort, and that, you know, that spawned a lot of individual movements, and the Clean Air Act was founded in 1970. But then you start thinking, well, what can we actually do? What is the problem? How do we know that it's a problem? And then you start breaking it apart into more scientific and social sub-areas, and looking at the cost of individual technologies or looking at the health impacts of individual problems. And so it's been kind of broken down into saying, well, let's look at individual pollutants, and let's look at them in the air, and let's come up with policies that can control that problem. But as the caller brings up, that, you know, maybe now it's time to start stepping back and looking at this as a little bit more of a system, or at least making sure that our air quality decisions are consistent with other goals. And I think Al Shea was alluding that can save a lot of costs, too, because if you're looking at all these problems separately, then sometimes the answer that you're coming to isn't necessarily the answer that you'd come to if you looked at everything together. Now, Al was referring to coordinating control policies for ozone, mercury, and PM2.5 together, but I think that that's sort of, let's first figure out how to coordinate strategies for what's going on in the air, but then, as the caller mentions, you know, we should then start making sure that we're addressing landfill issues and water issues as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. Obviously, you've studied the issue quite a bit. We have a couple lines open now. They've been crowded. 800-486-8655 if you'd like to join us. Or in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Professor Holloway, here's an email from Catherine McKenzie, a member of the Douglas County Board and chair of the Land Conservation Committee, member of the State Land and Water Conservation Committee. She writes, in Superior, the only particulate monitors are by industry. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources no longer has state monitors in this city, with the state's only oil refinery and shipping or coal and taconite. Industry must pay for their own testing. I'm told polluters will be found eventually.
Well, I think the shortage of monitors is definitely an issue. This PM2.5 was first regulated just back in 1997. So the regulation and the monitoring of this pollutant is fairly new, and the monitoring standards and the equipment that's used to monitor this is really improving all the time, both improving and reducing in cost. So I think one of the limitations to having broad coverage of PM2.5 monitors and having the state maintain those is really just a cost issue. And as Al Shea had noted, until now, until 2 days ago, there had not been any counties in Wisconsin in violation of the PM2.5 standard.
Mm-hmm.
And that had been because it had been a weaker standard.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in the counties where you have an air pollution problem, then they tend to put more monitors. And if there's no problem there, then they tend to think, well, this is a good way to save money than to put a monitor where everything seems clean.
Mm-hmm.
There is a big network of monitors maintained by the EPA that includes both rural and a different network that contains urban sites. So there is a lot of data across the Midwest, but that certainly it's not enough to cover all counties that should be.
Mike is joining us now from Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning. I have a specific question that I told the producer, but I also, based on the last couple of callers, wanted to make a comment. And that the comment is around the, or maybe it's more of a form of a general question, is the direction that we seem to be going in is that as we get increasing scrutiny and increasing science, that we seem to be tackling things on a case-by-case basis. But as the guest had talked about it, taking a systems-based approach, is that, you know, how much work is actually being done to demonstrate to the PSC and other regulatory and so forth groups that we need to be thinking more so about technologies that are already out there, like coal gasification and things of that nature, which have been essentially taken off the table by the PSC and other groups when these things get directly to it. But my specific question, and maybe it relates to that system-based approach, or at least the analytical probes that we can use to determine if our various regulatory approaches are effective, is the technology there now in a relatively cheap and easy way to keep continuous data monitoring such that we not only see the size of the particles and the number of particles per unit volume, but that we also have a, through chemical or physical analysis, that we can determine the specific sources so that as we do our continuous monitoring, that we can see if our various regulatory approaches are actually having the desired effect, or are we still stuck in a gross analysis of just particle size and then hoping our theoretical models are right?
Mike, that is a really great question because you brought up three issues. One is that right now we measure total bulk mass. The units that the standard is in, the daily standard, is 35 micrograms per meter cubed of air. That's just 35 micrograms of stuff. It doesn't really, it's not saying what kind of stuff. It's not saying how many particles. It's just saying the total mass of particles that are smaller than 2.5 microns. And this 2.5 microns, that's about 1/30th the diameter of human hair. So we're talking really, really small particles. But we do not have any general network measuring how many particles are in the air. So this number density, as it's called, is only measured at a few stations. That's hard data to get. And the measurements of what kind of particles, sort of what flavor. Al Shea mentioned that ammonium sulfate, ammonium nitrate, and organic carbon were the three largest contributors to PM2.5 in Wisconsin. There are a couple of other ones that are more minor contributors. And there are some networks. Actually, the EPA is called the EPA Speciation Trends Network, and it's called speciation because it's saying what type of particle is this? Is this a sulfur particle? Is this a nitrate particle? Mm. Is this a carbon particle? Is this elemental carbon, the kind of black smoke that you sometimes see coming out of a diesel vehicle? And there are some of those measurements, but they're not as widespread as the bulk PM2.5 monitors, in part because they are more expensive, and also because right now the composition of the particles is not used for regulation. We don't regulate sulfur particles differently than nitrate particles. We just regulate the whole family of particles together. And that may change down the road because the number one reason why we're regulating these particles is for their health impacts. And so you might say, well, gee, if there's all these different types of particles, do some of them have a different health effect than others? And that's really an open question in the health community. There are some researchers who think that it might be the sulfur in the particles that's the most damaging part. I think a more common view is that it's the carbon in the particles that are the more damaging part, but there's just not enough evidence out there yet to really say, you know, let's stop regulating all PM2.5 and start regulating only the sulfur, only the carbon part. So, because this is an area where the policy is developing quickly and the science is developing quickly, you know, if you don't have a monitor, it's hard to tell what the health effects are.
Sure.
If you don't know what the components are, it's hard to know which one is being most effectively controlled. But your caller is exactly right that even though those aren't everywhere and they're not used as a standard input to the policy process, they are. There's a number of those kind of monitors across the state of Wisconsin that do tell you what type of particle is being measured, and that those will be a real important indicator to be figuring out if the policies that are put into place are having the desired effect. If we're reducing if we're putting on scrubbers to reduce sulfur coming out of the power plants, what we would expect is for these network of monitors that can distinguish sulfur particles, or sulfate particles, particularly, we would expect that those to be going down in coming years as a, in response to these new technologies.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike, very much for the call. The part of the press report I didn't understand here goes like this. There is a period for public comment if the designations become a reality. New standards will create different rules with different responsibilities in different counties. What does this mean, if the designations become a reality?
Well, so right now what's going on is pretty much a conversation between the federal government in the EPA and the state DNR. And the conversation says, it's sort of like between a teacher and a student, like, what do you think your grade should be? Well, here's what I think your grade should be. And let's go back and forth until we come up with what we both can agree on is a fair grade for your performance here. And that, and, you know, following that sort of metaphor is that, that they had asked the states to submit an initial recommendation of what the states thought that they how they should be designated as being in or out of attainment. And so Governor Doyle sent a letter earlier this year to the federal EPA saying that we don't think any county in Wisconsin should be designated out of attainment.
Oh.
We've looked at the data. We've looked at our computer models, and we think that it's not fair for us to get anything less than a passing grade, in part because there's these planned improvements that are already on the books, and that, as Al Shea noted, that all these counties are expected to have air that passes the standard by 2015. So in Governor Doyle's letter, he said, you know, since we're right on track to having everything in compliance by 2015, we think we should be given a passing grade. And then the EPA responded, and this is just what came out a couple of days ago, saying, you know, dear Governor Doyle, mm-hmm. thank you for your recommendation, but we disagree.
I see.
And then they said, you know, here's, we think that there should be these six counties that are designated as out of containment. And now they say, if you disagree with our thinking, you can come back to us. But if you do, here's what we want to know.
I see.
X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is going to go back and forth a little bit. So it may be that not all of these six counties are formally designated as in attainment and need to formally do something. But it's what we've just gotten back in, on August 18th was the official letter from the federal government saying that they do not quite accept our, you know, as a state's recommended passing grade for all
mm-hmm.
counties.
We go to Mike next from Antigo. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Is there any place else in the country that gets cited for this sort of air pollution? And Larry Mueller has meteorologists on every once in a while, one of whom said water vapor has to form, condense around something in order to fall as rain. But no one asked him specifically the reverse question. If there were no particulate matter in the air, would there be no rainfall?
Oh, okay, those are great questions. With respect to the water vapor condensing, there's a lot of natural particulate matter in the air. So there would be, even if there were no humans living on Earth, there would be enough particles with wind-blown dust and some of the chemicals that just are naturally emitted by trees lead to aerosol formation. Or sorry, aerosol is the meteorologist term for a particulate matter. And so even if there were no humans on Earth, there would be enough of these particles in the air for clouds to form and rain to fall. But it's true that having more of these particles in the air will change cloud formation and precipitation patterns. Now, how much it will change them and in what way it will change them is actually a pretty hot topic of scientific research. But there's been evidence, for instance, that in China they would have a different rainfall pattern if they had cleaner air than they do now.
Hmm.
And so the caller's absolutely right, Mike, that's what the water vapor condenses around. there was a first part of that question that
What was the first part, Mike?
Maybe that was it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, I mean, I think that a broader issue around this cloud issue and the rainfall issue is that this particulate matter, although it's being regulated by the EPA to protect public health, is also very interesting from a weather and climate point of view. And when we're thinking about climate change, of course, you know, most people talk about carbon dioxide. That's the major component contributing to observed and projected warming. But these aerosols, these particulate matter in the atmosphere, also play a big role. And some types of this particulate matter cool the climate, and some types of this particulate matter warm the climate. So it actually starts making impacts on climate and weather, as well as health. And in fact, if you walk outside some days when it's really kind of hazy and hard to see very far, that anytime you can sort of see air pollution, that's also a particulate matter issue.
Mm-hmm. And the first part of the question was, are there any places elsewhere in the United States having this problem?
Yes, absolutely. This is a problem across almost every major industrial area of the United States. So California has a lot of counties out of compliance with the PM2.5 standard, and there's a lot of counties across the East Coast that are also out of compliance. And Chicago is out of compliance. Mm-hmm. So this is... Wisconsin is not unique in its being cited for these issues, because anywhere you have a lot of industrial activity, a lot of driving, a lot of power plants, you're going to get a lot of particulate matter. And in fact, even though in rural area, or in both rural and urban areas of the Southwest, this idea of wind-blown dust, that's actually a significant contributor to particulate matter concentrations in the southwestern United States. I mean, we don't have that so much here, but...
They do.
Yeah.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Tracy Holloway, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies, Atmospheric and Ocean Sciences, and Civil and Environmental Engineering at the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. We're talking about the EPA's statement to Wisconsin a couple days ago, citing six counties in our state for fine particle pollution. And I'll give you the – well – you can also send an email, because our lines are real busy here today, but the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, the author of I Never Metaphor I Didn't Like, a comprehensive compilation of history's greatest analogies, metaphors, and similes. Back to phone calls now. And we thank Mike for his call. Fern is next from Gilbert, Minnesota. Hi, Fern.
Hi. I do know that before the Clean Air Act was passed, research had been done on setting up standards for fine particulates. But the steel companies objected, and there was a little disagreement within the agency. So I'm wondering, when the EPA really got interested in fine particulates, this is a particular problem on the Iron Range. We have mesothelioma from asbestos. Sulfide companies are seeking permits to mine copper, nickel, gold, and platinum, and so on. Nickel is a known carcinogen. Nickel and cobalt together are toxic. The platinum group of metals are toxic. And somebody mentioned coal gasification. There's a company planning to set up a coal gasification here, and this the emission would be 10 million tons of CO2 per year. So I'd like your guest comments on what the questions I've raised.
Okay. Sure. Well, Fern raised a number of good points. In answer to her first issue about when the EPA started getting interested in Clean Air Act, I think, as she mentioned, it's been interested for a long time. One distinction to make is that dating back to the early stages of the Clean Air Act, they regulated what they call PM10, and this is particulate matter smaller than 10 microns. Now, remember, we're talking now about PM2.5, which is even smaller than that, and so they've been regulating this bigger group particulate matter for decades. And it was only in the mid-1990s that there was beginning to be enough evidence to say, wait, we can't just regulate all particulate matter. We should really focus on the smallest group of that, which they called PM2.5, everything less than 2.5 microns, because this is the part of particulate matter that can penetrate most deeply into the lungs and cause the most health impacts. So PM10 has been regulated, I think, since 1970, since the Clean Air Act was first formed, and there still is a PM10 regulation on the books, but it is rarely violated across the United States because that's easier to control. But PM2.5, the smaller fraction of that is, or the fraction of smaller particles of that, started being regulated in 1997. And then it's sort of one of these things that feedbacks on itself. Once you have some evidence that this is a problem, you can't get that evidence without having some monitors. But then once you start having a policy where you're really trying to regulate it, then you put a lot more monitors out, and then there's an interest in developing better and better monitors. And as you have better monitors and better data, then you can say, wait, actually, this is more of a problem than we thought it was. And that is the thinking that went into the strengthening of the PM2.5 standard in 2006. And so then it was really reduced the daily standard. What they thought was an acceptable concentration on any one day used to be 65 micrograms per meter squared, and then it was reduced to 35 micrograms per meter squared per day just in 2006. And so that's what we're really struggling with here.
Mm-hmm.
Fern mentioned a number of different carcinogenic pollutants, and I think it's important to note that when we're talking about PM2.5, as we've been doing for the past hour, this is really not from a cancer-causing perspective, because the thought is that with exposure to carcinogens, there's no safe level of exposure, so they try to keep everything as low as possible. But this idea of setting 35 micrograms is an acceptable level. That's sort of premised on the idea that if you're below it, everything is okay. And so the kind of health impacts that are motivating this PM2.5 rule are asthma, bronchitis, heart disease, premature mortality, but not cancer. And so the type of regulation that is written for these toxic cancer-causing compounds, and then right now the EPA regulates about 188 toxic substances, is more specific to each source and each chemical, and that's pretty different than what we're talking about, but they're certainly related because, as Fern noted, they come from a lot of the same sources. Mm-hmm.
Are you confident, Professor Holloway, that we're going to be able to lower these emissions in the not-too-distant future?
Yes. The nice thing about working on these kind of air pollution problems and both ozone and particulate matter is that there are solutions. There are cars out there that have cleaner burning engines, have better miles per gallon. As Al Shea noted, there's a lot of technologies, expensive technologies, but that exist to be putting onto individual power plants to reduce their emissions. The solutions exist. It's just a matter of how much we're willing to pay for them. And that's one reason why the Clean Air Act and the EPA was established, is to enforce some minimum level of air quality across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it is definitely a tractable problem. Fern also noted changes with the coal gasification plant and carbon dioxide emissions, and that carbon dioxide is not currently regulated. That's the species of concern for global warming and climate change, and that is much more difficult to control because there are no technologies that you can just put on a tailpipe to reduce the CO2.
Right.
But when it comes to these regulated air pollution emissions, there are definitely solutions out there. So, and from everything I've read, it really does look like Wisconsin is on track to be solving these problems by 2015. But at this point, the EPA says, you know, they want to give us the grade not on what we will be doing, but on what things are currently in the recent past.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let's take one more call. We only have about 30 seconds, though. Guy, hi, Guy.
Yeah, just just a quick note. I think that one of the reasons why the EPA is doing what it is because the state of Wisconsin ranks in the bottom five in terms of enforcement of the Clean Air Act across the country. They have great laws but don't enforce the law. I was a litigant against Xcel Energy on one of the, well, it was the third largest polluter at the time in 2000, an Xcel garbage burning plant in across Wisconsin, and it was only because of a lawsuit and then the settlement between myself and an attorney firm, the Midwest Environmental Advocates, that forced Xcel to change. The reality is that it seems like the only way to solve the problem in the state of Wisconsin is not through the state, but through individual lawsuits, as we've just seen in the Pullman case.
Would you agree, yes or no? We're out of time, Tracy.
I think the litigation plays a major role in getting these rules passed.
Thank you so much for being with us. You're a wonderful guest. Very informative.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Professor Tracy Holloway, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences and Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Treader for on-air production, and thanks for all of your great calls. We'll return following the news.